Welcome to Changemaker with founder of Gypsy Tea and social entrepreneur Zina Muzika.
This new podcast is to help you embrace change and experience amazing people and entrepreneurs. We're going to be sharing secrets, habits, and change-making abilities with you so that you can apply them to your life and make a life of your dreams.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzika.
Hey, Changemakers. Welcome to another episode of Changemaker. I'm your host, Zina Muzika. I'm here with somebody that I brag about all the time about how brilliant he is, how beautiful inside and out, how his marriage to his beautiful wife has been really an inspiration to me and has led me to the best marriage I can possibly imagine with my husband, Gerard. His name is Gay Hendricks. He's been a leader in the fields of relationship transformation and body-mind therapies for over 45 years, but he doesn't look a day over 45, so we'll have to get into that. And after earning his PhD in counseling psychology from Stanford, Gay served as professor of counseling psychology at the University of Colorado for 21 years. He's written and co-authored with Katie 35 books, which is actually a low number now. You're up closer to 40 now, huh, Gay?
I think so, yes.
Including the bestseller Conscious Loving, used as a primary text in universities around the world. In 2003, Gay co-founded the Spiritual Cinema Circle, which distributes inspirational movies and conscious entertainment to subscribers in 70-plus countries. And he offers seminars worldwide. He's appeared on more than 500 radio and television shows, including Oprah, CNN, CNBC, 48 Hours, and others. Gay, and he's also my adopted spiritual father. Which is a lot of work.
Not a bit at all. It's entirely my pleasure.
Well, welcome to Changemaker, Gay. I really, you know, wanted to interview you. I've interviewed you before, but I went to a reading Friday night at your house where you were reading some of your mystery novels that have yet to be published. You're in the fifth. I think you're on the fifth of the series of your mystery novels.
Yes, four of them have been published already, and now we're working on number five.
Okay, so you said something at the reading, and we were all transfixed, and you were reading about this Tibetan Buddhist private detective, you know, Private Eye, and I've loved these books, and Ten is such an exciting character. And, you know, you mentioned something about the writing process that I want us to really help our readers understand, because I think so many people think that they have to wait till inspiration strikes or the book is, you know, outlined perfectly. And you had a different approach to writing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I've never been very good at making outlines, even when I had to do it in high school and college and that kind of thing. It never really seemed to get to the essence of how I wanted to communicate and how I create things. I go more from inside out rather than outside in. And I have great respect for people who can make outlines and meticulously follow them. I have friends who do that. I'm just wired a different way. What I do is, like with my private detective, I put myself in his position and I feel, what's he feeling right now and what does he need to do next and what is the thing that next needs to happen? And then I write that. You know, it's kind of living from inside him, and the mystery unfolds. I don't even know what the mystery is going to be when I start writing the book. I have a kind of a feeling for it in my body, but I don't have the outline of it yet, and it begins to unfold itself. And that's what's so fun about it for me and what allows me to learn a lot in the writing process. You know, sometimes I cry when I'm writing if I hit a spot where it has a deep personal resonance with me, and sometimes I laugh, and sometimes I'm amazed at what this character does because he's very unlike me in many ways. And so for me, though, it all comes from this inside out thing of kind of like running my own movie, but from inside my chest, so to speak. It's a different kind of feeling. It's not exactly seeing visual scenes. It's more like feeling it out from inside myself.
And that, I think, has been, I mean, you and Katie wrote Conscious Loving. When did you guys write that?
I think it was published in about 25 years ago. I think we were first on Oprah with it in 1992. So what is that, about, you know, close to 25 years ago?
Yeah. And it is all about feeling. I've done your trainings, your conscious loving and conscious living trainings, and it really is about the body intelligence. It really is that, you know, we feel and then our minds process it. Can you talk a little bit about what you and Katie have created with the Hendricks Institute and all of that? And then our listeners can hear kind of the breadth of the knowledge, because this creative process that you've brought to writing mystery novels after a huge career in nonfiction is really inspirational. And I think a lot of people who want to make a big change in their life can learn from it.
Well, when we started our life together now 35 years ago, there weren't any self-help books on how to have a good relationship. And we looked around for people that we could model, and we didn't really find very many role models of the kind of relationship we wanted. And so we went about creating it ourselves. And two or three of the things that we learned in the first few years became things that we wrote about in Conscious Loving that resonated with the audience. And one of them was this idea of being emotionally transparent to the other person, not hiding feelings. I'd been in relationships where, you know, if you said, what are you feeling right now? The other person would say, I'm fine. You know, it's like a constant trying to peel away, you know, to try to get to what was really going on. And I wanted a kind of relationship with transparency. And so we both agreed on that that's what we wanted. And so we just began to, you know, tell the truth to each other about things that would come up. And the second thing we realized was that in other relationships, criticism and blame had eaten up a lot of the positive energy in the relationships. And we did this radical thing when we first got together. We decided to make our relationship a blame-free relationship and to do our best to eliminate any kind of criticism from each about each other from it. And it took us a few years to do it, you know, but because we both came from very critical kind of backgrounds, and
yeah,
we were used to bickering a lot and everything. But, you know, once we did it, it's been, wow, you know, 20, 30 years now since anybody said anything critical to each other around the house. And it makes for a very different sort of environment.
It's breathtaking.
The one I grew up with.
No, it's breathtaking. And I, you know, I do remember when I first met you, it was, God, 13, 14 years ago, and you and Katie were so respectful of each other's expression and space that I immediately went home and broke up with my fiancé at the time, because I thought, oh my God, I'll never be able to do what they're doing with this person. Not that he was a bad person, but he just wasn't my match. And you were so well matched, and you're so passionate and in love with each other and so generous with each other. It's always struck me, and you're consistently so.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. One of the things that Katie and I were very impeccable about in the early days, we said, once we go out in public, we want to be able to walk our talk. We don't want to have anything that hasn't been kitchen tested at home.
Well, I will say, because I know you guys would be okay with this. Normally, I wouldn't say it, but I do remember before I knew you guys super well, I remember seeing you guys at Rainbow Bridge, which is our local natural product store, and you grabbed her butt in line. And I remember thinking, okay, you know, 28 years or however long it had been, I thought, okay, that's the marriage for me. That's what I'm going to have.
I hadn't heard that story before. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you guys are playful and you're the real deal. So tell me how body intelligence comes into deciding not to have a critical life. And can you talk a little bit about your overall theory, because it really does lead, you know, it's profound in its simplicity, and it does also lead to this talk on, you know, how to change your life.
Yes, well, one of the things that human beings struggle with, and I've been a therapist for much of my life and working with people in seminars and that kind of thing, I've seen people all over the world in different cultures now, and one thing that just about everybody struggles with is their relationships with their inner emotions and how to feel those and how to express those. And it doesn't matter if you're in China or India or Beverly Hills, everybody's struggling with that same issue. And so one of the problems is that in the growing up process, we gradually lose touch with what I call your body intelligence, your ability to know, for example, where you feel your feelings in your body. It's a natural gift, like tender emotions like sadness tend to be around mm-hmm. your chest and your throat. That's where many people feel them. Anger emotions tend to make your spine kind of stand up and your muscles tighten in your back and your jaw tighten, and fear tends to be something that you feel in your belly. But we don't get much training in how to identify these. So you get people coming in for counseling in their 20s and 30s who are absolutely body ignorant. I'll say to a person, what are you feeling right now? And they say, I don't know. Well, how's that possible? You know, because if I ask the same person, are you thirsty right now? They could tell me yes or no. But the same thing with emotions, we could learn to recognize them just as much as we could easily with learning to recognize whether we're hungry or thirsty, and yet we don't. So that's why I mean that by the time you come out of high school, you're mind smart but body stupid, because you've been out of touch with yourself for so long. As a matter of fact, I think there was a study that Katie was talking about, my wife, Kathleen. She is a movement therapist, and there was a study that kids have access to 2,000 or 3,000 different movements that they do before they start school, and by the time they get out of school, they're down to 200 or 300 different movements, so that we lose a lot of our natural gifts by kind of being sitting still for 12 years.
And then we get medicated if we don't sit still enough at school.
Exactly. And so that's the kind of the ultimate outcome of being not body intelligent, is that you lose touch with your natural organic ability to learn from your body and to read its signals. And so, you know, we have on this planet people who have remained very sensitive in their bodies. Like I read a while back about African bushmen who can feel the vibration of a buffalo moving 9 miles away. They say they can feel it in their calves. And now I'm not that sensitive anymore. I've lost my ability to detect buffalo. I probably couldn't feel them on the next block. But, you know, the civilization takes us in many ways away from our natural body intelligence and forces us to focus more on the outside and how our body looks rather than how it's feeling inside. So now we have epidemics, of course, of people who look pretty good on the outside and are extraordinarily well-groomed but don't feel good about themselves and don't work well in their relationships on the inside. So relationships are really an inside job first and foremost, because you always get the kind of love outside that you give to yourself inside, and so it's always a natural reflection. And so you really do need to start the process by looking down in there and saying, what are my feelings toward myself? How much do I love and value and accept myself?
I agree. We talk a lot about self-care now because the burnout epidemic is, I just wrote an article for Success Magazine about burnout and just how pandemic it is and how little we are caring for ourselves, because we're just adding more and more work to our workloads out of fear. And so tell us, like, when body intelligence is okay, so you have a sense, all right, I'm feeling fear right now and I can feel it in my gut, or I can feel it in my solar plexus. Then what?
Well, the moment you communicate that, the moment you acknowledge it to yourself, first of all, you've made a mind-body connection. You've become more body intelligent. You say, okay, I've got butterflies in my belly. That's telling me I'm scared. And so let's say you're sitting with your husband or a colleague. Why not even say that? Why not say, mm-hmm. you know, I'm noticing some feelings in my stomach right now. I think I'm scared about something. You know, you want that kind of intimate relationship, I think, with people that you want to be close to. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that you need to do that with the paper boy or the, you know, the checkout person or something like that.
I'm having a sense of frustration that was very expensive. I can feel it in my...
No, but only communicate the absolute truth to the people you care most about and you want to be closer to, because, you know, like Eric Byrne once said, most people don't experience 15 minutes of genuine intimacy in their entire lifetimes.
Oh,
and I remember when I heard him say that, you know, it was very depressing.
It is depressing.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it's really true in many ways, but we want to change that. We want to have hours of intimacy a day. That's what I'm looking for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It strikes me also that, you know, you and Katie now, you know, you teach, I come to these classes and you teach, but it's a lot of game playing. Can you talk a little bit about fun and levity?
Yes, by game playing, we're referring to games like role playing and different groups.
Yeah, there's balloons and we're all hitting the balloons in the air. We're running around doing silly things, yet we're healing. Yes. Yet we're figuring out what's going on inside.
Yes, we discovered something quite amazing a long time ago, which is people learn more when they're having a good time. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't see people crying and sharing deep feelings and that kind of thing. So you can do all of that in a context of having a good time learning and discovering things about yourself. And so we have just as many deep emotions released in the form of things that come up during play oftentimes than in a deep traditional kind of therapy kind of a situation. And it's true around the world, too. When we first went to Japan, for example, the organizer of the thing says, oh, you won't see Japanese people cry in a setting like this unless they have a couple of drinks. And so, but yet they were crying just like anybody else in any other culture within hours. And so, and they were laughing at the same time. So the two things, I think, come together, that the more you open yourself and make yourself an open space for having a good time in life, the deeper and faster you can do the deep work on yourself. And it's certainly a lot more pleasant to be around.
Absolutely. And a lot of people really want to do the work on themselves, but they don't know how. You know, there's so much hidden inside of our cellular structure. I worked with a shaman last weekend and I got the sense I wanted to learn what it felt like to actually trust. And it wasn't in my head. It was a sensation when I committed to feeling what it felt like to actually completely trust my surroundings, completely be in trust. It was a bursting feeling in my heart. It was a warm, oozing, wonderful, like feel. It was a sensation. Whereas I'd been always looking for it in my head. Why can't I trust my future the way that, you know, I know I can't, you know, I should, or, you know, I was always neck up, but I had this, you know, just another validation of your work in body intelligence, just knowing that trust was a physical sensation.
That's a beautiful awareness. I was tuning into that, where I feel that in my body as you were speaking of it. And for me, it does have a lot to do with down in my belly, you know, like maybe down past where fear lives.
I think so much of it too is we want to get past our childhoods. We want to say, oh, I'm healed from that, or, oh, I'm not a whiner, or, oh, I'm not going to go. And yet so much of our lives are you know, figured out by the time we're, like you said, 5 or 10, you know, we're not moving anymore. We freeze up. And I think all those memories are actually frozen in our bodies. And until we can warm them up and loosen them up again and breathe through them, you know, it's hard to know.
Yeah, it really is. And this is also where body intelligence comes in, because there are some things you cannot figure out with your mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you really can't figure out something like love with your mind. You have to go down into the depths into your body and find out where do I feel it and where don't I feel it, and do I love myself and do I honor myself? Those kinds of big questions can only really be answered from the neck down, because that's where those emotions often have the most resonance for us.
Well, and that's what I love. So you have written so many nonfiction books. You just are very prolific and you write a page a day. And then all of a sudden you decided to switch to fiction. And So, and it did have to do with your body intelligence and trusting, you know, what it felt like to go down a new creative path. Can you talk about how you met this amazing character that you're now on book five? And, you know, can you talk a little bit about how you met him and what it looked like that morning?
Yes. Well, it was one of the great moments of my life. I should first say that I've been wanting to write mystery novels probably since I was 12 years old, when I first had a copy of Sherlock Holmes in my hands, and I became an avid Sherlock Holmes fan from probably the time I was 12 years old up until the time I was 14. Well, I remember for sure I was totally into him in the ninth grade, because my ninth grade English teacher used to call me Sherlock all the time because I would carry around Sherlock Holmes with me. But it made a deep impression on me, and I knew that somehow I didn't want to be a detective, you know, like actually be a policeman or something like that, but I wanted to write detective novels. And so that stuck in the back of my mind, and I filed it away for 40 years or so. And then one night about 5 years ago, in the middle of the night, I woke up around 3 a.m., and I didn't want to, well, actually, I wanted to read my mystery novel that I'd gone to sleep reading, but I didn't want to turn the light back on, and because Katie was sleeping there and that kind of thing. So I decided to make up my own mystery novel. And my first thought was, what kind of character would I most like to interact with? And the answer came back, well, he'd have to be kind of interested in spiritual things, but he also got to be street smart at the same time. And so popped up in my mind a picture of a sort of a Eurasian, part Asian man, about 30 years old, standing on the cliffs down at the Pacific Palisades in Southern California, looking out over the Pacific Ocean back toward Asia. And the story that he kind of came with was that he had grown up partly in a monastery, a Tibetan Buddhist monastery in India. His father was a Tibetan Buddhist, and his mother was a American spiritual hippie, spiritual seeker who had come to that monastery, and they had this fling. And it, anyway, that's the background.
How scandalous.
Yeah, very scandalous. So he has trouble with relationships because of the craziness that he had around him growing up. And so I started talking to him and then asking him, well, how did you get here? And then he told me how he got there. And I, what are you working on right now? And then he would tell me what he was working on. And so he just gradually started narrating the story. And so that's how that all came to pass. And I haven't gotten tired of him yet. I'm now actually, we've written, we've got number five, and then we've got six and seven kind of that we're tinkering with right now in various stages of development. So I know I'm still fascinated with him after seven books or so.
That's amazing. It's amazing. And his character too, like you said, he, you know, I love in your reading, you know, he's in Paris. He you get to go to all the cool places with this guy.
Yeah. And wait till you see what's to come too. He's got some really cool ones. In fact, he's going to visit a little town in Southern California called Ojai, California. I can hardly wait to find out what mysteries unravel here.
That is so fun.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zena Muzyka.
So the creative process for you, you're toward book 40, or you might have already hit book 40. You write, and you also are an entrepreneur. You're also a teacher. You're also a very, you know, dedicated husband. Can you talk about why and how you can accomplish so much?
Well, I think the things we talk about as the relationship principles really free up a lot of energy. For example, if you don't ever have to recover from blame and criticism, or you know, you don't ever have to go around trying to figure out what the other person is thinking and feeling, you free up a lot of energy that can go into your creativity. So that's one thing I've found. But also, I think when Katie and I got together, one of the things that we honored about each other was our individual creative process. You know, I really thought that she was an incredibly creative person, and she felt the same way about me. And so we kind of protect that in each other. We kind of are for that in each other all the time, the evolution of each of our creative processes. And I think that a lot of people find themselves, as I have found myself in the past, in my pre-Katie days, I found myself in relationships where creativity got eaten up by the amount of drama and, you know, Sturm und Drang in the relationship that was going on, that everybody's creative energy got deflated as a result of being in the relationship. And so we've gone to great extremes to make sure we've created an opposite kind of environment where we really celebrate creativity here and appreciate it in each other.
Yeah, and it's true, but it's also so key that both parties, both people in the relationship, are committed to that. You know, I remember learning your fear melters, and my husband and I used to always have the same fight. And we would have this fight, and obviously it was, you know, I can't remember even what it was about. It was something to do with money, but I don't remember what it was. That's, I mean, I had this fight for 7 years, and then all of a sudden now I can't even remember what it was about. That's how important it was.
Isn't that amazing? I love that.
But I remember doing the first conscious loving training, and I felt this fight coming back on with him, and I had deja vu, like, oh, here we go again. But I literally had deja vu. I was like, oh my God, I'm in a cycle. Like, I'm actually reliving this conflict over and over again. Obviously, you know, people who fight tend to fight about the same things over and over again. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try this fear melter thing because I'm obviously scared of something. Otherwise, I wouldn't be feeling attacked, or I wouldn't be feeling like I have to defend myself or fight. And I did one of the silly, you know, I did sumo, which is, you know, I'm the type of, you know, when I fight, I like to run away from a fight. And so you have this exercise to stand in the fear and to settle into it. And it was literally, my husband looked at me like, what are you doing? I'm like, hey, just do this. And, you know, so we're both standing there like sumo wrestlers in the dining room looking at each other, you know, eye to eye. And he's like, wow, I don't even feel like fighting anymore. I'm like, I know. Isn't this weird? Like, it was just these fun little games, and then the breathing exercises and stuff. And it really, you know, they can find, our listeners can find fear melters on Hendrix.com, right?
Yes, it's on there, the videos and everything. And just go to Hendrix, HENDRICKS.com, and look up the fear melters. It's one of Katie's biggest, best inventions, I think.
Oh, amazing, amazing. And it's so instantaneous because it does just take you out of, you know, fear. And we don't realize how much we're walking around in fear all the time, fear to be exposed, fear to be unloved or rejected. And I think that's why a lot of people who want to change their life or create the life of their dreams, they're scared that it won't work out or they won't be able to do it. So they just don't go there. And, you know, there's so many of us walking around, well, so many people walking around without, you know, a chance at their dreams because they're too scared to make the leap. And you wrote a book called The Big Leap, which is a classic. It's a great, great, great book. Can you give our listeners just a couple tips as we wind down from, you know, taking a leap into the future?
Yes. Well, The Big Leap is really about two big things. One of them is the upper limit problem.
I love that. ULP.
Yeah, which is ULP, U-L-P, the upper limit problem, which is the tendency to sabotage yourself when things are going well. And I kind of take that apart in the book and show people what it's based on, and that helps them then unwind that in themselves. So the number one concept that I work on is the upper limit problem. The second one is a natural outflow once you start handling your upper limit problem, and that is how to live in your zone of genius. And your zone of genius is when you're doing the things that you most love to do, and they are the things that also bring you the greatest ratio of abundance when you do them. And so you want to home your life in on doing more and more of the things that are in your zone of genius. And in The Big Leap, I show a way to do that in an efficient way so that you can open up a dialogue on a daily basis with your zone of genius and spend your life and make good fortune doing what you most love to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people talk about do what you love and the money will follow, but it's so hard to make that leap. And I think one of the things, you know, out of that book, really the upper limit problem, I had no idea I was even doing it. So anytime I would have a big win, I would call one of my depressed friends and let them, you know, kind of, you know, bring me down. Or I had these unconscious patterns of, you know, not wanting to be too happy or too successful. And it wasn't that I didn't want to be happy and successful. It's that I didn't think deep down, I didn't think I actually deserved it. And, you know, I love the tools you give in The Big Leap to kind of, you know, start to, you know, up that upper limit problem. But then in the zone of genius, I feel like so many of our listeners are wanting to feel really good about the work they do every day. They want it to feel like play. And, you know, some of them would love to make money golfing or some of them, but you know, what would be one step you can leave our listeners with on how to actually find that zone of genius and how it actually settles into the body?
The first step I recommend is everybody can find 10 minutes. Okay. So I want you to find 10 minutes, preferably the day you're hearing this before you go to bed that night, just spend 10 minutes doing what you most love to do, whatever it is that you can think of right then that you most love to do. It could be reading some poetry. It could be writing some poetry. It could be working on the recipe for a great soup. But whatever it is, it engages love. It engages your heart. And what we have found that if you start with 10 minutes, just 10 minutes, that becomes addictive, and you want to do a little bit more every day, and pretty soon you're living in your zone of genius without having to make any radical changes. You just open up a bigger door for that every day.
Absolutely. And setting even a digital timer to, I mean, that's how I learned to meditate. I just would set my digital timer for 7 or 11 minutes a day, and I would sit and do it. And all of a sudden, you know, years have passed and I'm a meditator now. And I think you're absolutely right. Just a few minutes every day, and then feel that feeling that you can make space for it actually opens the door to it.
Yeah, a friend of mine got in shape by... He hated to go to the gym, but he made himself do one chin-up a day for a week. So he did 7 chin-ups his first week. And then the second week, he set the goal of doing 2 chin-ups a day. But by the end of the year, he was doing 52 chin-ups a day and had built, you know, he dropped 40 pounds. And, you know, just by that one little change starting. And
yeah.
So I think the power of making tiny little choices is really where it's at.
I agree. Well, Gay Hendricks, thank you so much for joining me on Changemaker. For our listeners, you can find more about Gay and his beautiful wife, Katie. They have heartsintrueharmony.com, and they also have Hendricks.com. It's H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S. The videos are awesome. Gay and Katie are so warm and so genuinely here to help you live with more love and consciousness, and they've dedicated their entire life to it. And I also would love for you to go check them out on Facebook. They've got very fun posts and videos and memes on Facebook. You can find me on Facebook at ZHENA or on Twitter at Mistress of Tea. And I am so grateful to have you here, Gay. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the miracle that you are, Tina.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Dad. Okay. Great.
Bye.
Thank you.